You grab a seat and pick up a Bible. Our next reading is from page 889 in the Black Bibles in front of you, 889, John chapter 4. We're going to pick up from verse 43. This is concluding these four chapters we've been studying in John. John chapter 4, and I'll read from verse 43. So after the 2 days, he, Jesus, departed for Galilee, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. So he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him." The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Great, do keep that open, and this sheet will be a great help to you. The insides of it have got some points that we're going to be looking at together. I'm going to begin actually with a couple of quotes from very different places, but with a very similar feel to them. The first one is from the journalist Matt Walker. This was a quote I lifted off the BBC website, and he said this: "Science cannot challenge faith, because faith, by its very nature, does not require evidence." Here's another comment about faith, and it's on the same theme of faith being essentially irrational, but it's from an older source, and you'll pick up where it's from. "There's no use trying," Alice said. "One cannot believe impossible things." "I dare say you haven't had much practice," said the Queen. "When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." And that is the Alice through the looking glass view of faith. And I guess there'll be people here who are pretty sympathetic with that view of faith, that faith is essentially daft and irrational, and that view that faith, by definition, means believing in things when really common sense and all the evidence points the other way. And a lot of people hold that kind of view of faith, that it's essentially a leap in the dark. And then once somebody has defined faith in that way, it seems not just daft, but it seems elusive. So obviously some people have this thing called faith, other people don't have it. And then the people who do have it are busy trying to insist that everyone else has to have it the way they do. And they even up the stakes and say that your eternal destiny hangs on it. But on that kind of view of faith, how on earth do you get it? Because as Alice says, there's no use trying. One cannot believe impossible things. And actually, this issue of faith being the key determinant of where we end up ultimately forever, which is what the Bible teaches, we've seen that through John's Gospel, that is a pretty unsettling idea, even for believers, because the Bible teaches that it's possible to think that you have faith and not to have real faith. So Jesus says in another place that there will be people on the day of judgment who say to him, "Lord, Lord, did we not do many mighty works in your name?" And then Jesus will declare to them, "I never knew you." Now that is a very disturbing, that's a frightening thought. It's the equivalent of being stuck out at sea and you're next to drowning, and you know that your one hope is that rescue helicopter that's just spotted you. And faith is the carabiner. It's that clip, the hook, that can connect you to that rescue. And then you find out that there are two kinds of hooks, two carabiners. One that will hold your weight and will get you out to safety, and one that won't. One that you will find at the crucial moment will be completely useless to you. Now, isn't that a frightening thought? And the answer to all of these issues about the first one that we're looking at, faith being essentially irrational, that it's a leap in the dark, and also that it seems elusive, you know, how then do you get it? And also about faith being slippery and uncertain, you know, how do you know if you've got the right kind of faith? The answer to all of these issues is to understand what the nature of true faith is. Because once we see what real faith is, we'll see not simply that it's rational and it's very sensible, we'll also see that the Bible gives us a very straightforward way, not simply to get it, but also to know whether our faith is the real thing, so that we can make sure that we have secured ourselves properly onto Jesus' rescue. And the first thing John wants to underline for us in these verses, if you've got one of these sheets in front of you, is this issue that there is such a thing as false faith. I'm going to give a quick recap, especially for those who are here for the first time today. I'm going to give a recap of where Jesus has been over the last couple of chapters. Jesus is a northerner. He's from a place called Galilee up in the north of the country, where people have this thick provincial accent. Back in chapter 2, he went to a wedding up in the north in a place called Cana in Galilee. He did this incredible miracle, and we saw that at the beginning of chapter 2, and he turned water into wine on an incredible scale, something like 700 bottles worth. Then, if you've got your Bibles there, chapter 2, verse 13, flip back a page, we read, "The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." It says up, even though it's south, because it's the capital city. Jesus heads all the way to the capital in the south, and while he's in the south, he makes a big name for himself, partly because he causes a big scene in the temple, partly because, and we're told this in chapter 2, 23, he did some miracles. Chapter 2, 23, "Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing." That's the miracles. Then, after a quick trip to the countryside near Jerusalem to see John the Baptist, his relative, in chapter 4, verse 3, we learn that Jesus heads home again to Galilee in the north. He left, verse 3, Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. And we heard over the last 2 weeks how he had this very exciting time in Samaria. He didn't perform any miracles there, but loads of people believed in him because of what he said. So pick up from verse 40. "So when the Samaritans came to him, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his word." And then our section begins, this is what you've been waiting for, chapter 4, verse 43. And as verse 43 says, "After the 2 days, he departed for Galilee." So he begins this 50-mile walk back to home territory. And before we get back up to Galilee, John the writer, he sets our expectations very low. Look at verse 44. "For Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown." So even before we get into this episode, we're expecting that, even though Jesus is very popular in the Big Smoke in Jerusalem and he's made a name for himself there, we're expecting things are going to be much harder for him back home. Perhaps there'd be an over-familiarity with him. But then we read verse 45, "So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him." Do you see the puzzle that's being set for us? Verse 44 tells us we're to expect things to go badly, that he won't be honored. But then when he gets there, verse 45, he is welcomed. So already we're thinking, what is going on? And the rest of verse 45 helps us to unravel this puzzle. Look again at 45. "So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him." having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. And this helps us. We're learning here that the reason that the Galileans welcomed Jesus is because of the miracles they've seen Jesus do when he was back in Jerusalem. That was why I gave you a bit of his travel plans. So this immediately points us backwards to what has already happened in chapter 2. And I'd like you to turn again to chapter 2, 23, because John wants us to notice this connection with what happened in chapter 2. Verse 23, now when Jesus was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs, the miracles that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. And what we saw in those verses when we were in chapter 2 was that Jesus did lots of miracles in Jerusalem, lots of people believed in him, but Jesus is not impressed at all with their faith. And he finds something missing, something inadequate and lacking in it. Sure, big crowds are believing it in him, but it's not true faith. He's not impressed. So already in our section, John is alerting us to this whole issue of true faith and false faith. And we're wondering what the difference is. Let's keep going. Verse 46. So Jesus came again, this is chapter 4, 46, Jesus came again to Cana in Galilee where he had made the water wine. We're being alerted there, Jesus is at the very place where he's already known as a miracle worker. Let's keep going. And at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill. Capernaum also up in the north, about 15 miles away from Cana. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea in the south to Galilee in the north, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So there's the context of what's going on, but listen to how Jesus responds to this man. And initially I think you'll find this is quite strange. Look at verse 48. But Jesus said to him, unless you, and that's you plurals, unless you people see signs and wonders, you people will not believe. Now, Jesus is talking there to one individual, but as he does so, he's characterizing this whole region. In contrast to Samaria, as we've just seen, he's contrasting this, he's saying this region is characterized by those who demand to see miracles before they will believe. So Jesus is already giving us this first telltale sign of what characterizes false faith. Do you see? False faith, as I put on the sheets, keeps demanding more proof. That's what verse 48 says. Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will not believe. I think it's worth just stopping there for a moment and considering this whole issue, which I raised at the beginning, of evidence and faith. And I imagine already looking at verse 48, there'll be some people who are thinking, yeah, that's exactly what I would expect. You're telling me to ignore evidence, ignore proof, switch off my rational faculties and just leap into the dark. Just like that BBC journalist was saying, faith by its very nature does not require evidence. It's irrational. But I want to underline that that is not the Bible's view of true faith. In fact, evidence is vital to true faith. It's the basis for it. So how exactly does our writer John expect people to get true faith? How does a person come to believe in Jesus? It's worth thinking about. Faith isn't a trait like blue eyes that just some people are born with and some people aren't. Faith isn't something that we just suddenly wake up with one morning, randomly. And nor do we, like the White Queen from Alice Through the Looking Glass, do we just screw up our eyes and try as hard as we can to believe something that we know isn't true. No, John tells us elsewhere there is a route to gaining faith in Jesus. And it involves none of those things. It just involves looking at the evidence about Jesus and then acknowledging who Jesus is and putting your confidence in him. So I think this might be one of our last cross-references. Let's look at John chapter 20. This is page 907. Andrew's taken us to these verses before because they're such important verses for understanding the whole Gospel of John. John chapter 20, 30 to 31. And this is something of a purpose statement for the whole book. And as I read it, I want you to think about this connection of evidence and faith. John chapter 20, verse 30. Now Jesus did many other signs, miracles, in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life, eternal life, in his name. So do you see the point? John is saying that the way faith in Jesus comes about is as a result of the evidence of Jesus' miraculous signs. And people can either see these signs, as people literally did during Jesus' earthly life. So you remember after the wedding at Cana, the disciples see the sign and put their faith in him. Or the other way, this is for you and for me, now that Jesus has gone into heaven and we can't see him anymore, we hear the apostles' testimony of these signs, which is what we've got here in the Bible. And these verses here, chapter 20, 30, 31, anticipate that this is now the normal way that a person can get faith today. And actually, billions of people across the world have come to faith by precisely this means. They've looked into the apostles' record here in the Bible of Jesus' signs, and they've put their confidence in Jesus. So if you're here today, as I know what people will be, wanting faith, and you're uncertain about, you know, which way to turn, or perhaps you're a bit unsure and you just want more faith, what do you do? Well, don't screw up your eyes and just try and believe. What you need to do is actually immerse yourself and engage with the evidence. It's here in the Gospels, so come along Sunday by Sunday as we present it, or look yourself, and then answer the question, is Jesus who he claims? And that's the route to getting faith. And obviously then, if I want other people to have faith in Jesus, and if we love people, of course that's what we'll long for them, how do we help someone have true faith? That's a good question. Well, the church I grew up in, which is a brilliant church in loads of ways, they used to put adverts up around the village inviting everyone to come to special healing services. And the hope was that they would see a dramatic healing and then they would put their faith in Jesus. Now, God is powerful. And though he hasn't promised physical healing in this life, he can heal. And sometimes in his kindness, he does heal miraculously. But the point I'm trying to make here is that's not the way God has given us to help people to believe. In fact, Jesus is at the center of history, not me. And so the miracles are deliberately clustered around his life and not my life. That's a deliberate thing that God has done. He's designed it that way. And so what we need to do to encourage people to believe is for them to engage with the evidence around Jesus' life that God has given us, and then pray that they will see who Jesus is and put their confidence in him. So Jesus is warning us in verse 48 about this attitude that keeps saying, I need more proof, more proof. God needs to show himself more clearly before I will put my faith in Jesus. And you'll probably have come across people who get stuck, spiritually speaking. They make a good start, they're asking the right questions, but they keep asking more and more questions about the faith, and it doesn't matter how many answers they get, they still won't shift and they won't put their confidence in Jesus. And if that's the case, sometimes it's worth asking that person, thank you for your questions, if I were to answer your questions now satisfactorily, would you put your confidence in Jesus? Because actually, there's not much point having the conversation if it's not going to make any difference. What amount of evidence would be enough for you? And I think that's a really important approach to take because it clarifies for someone where the issue is. Is the issue in me that no amount of evidence is ever going to persuade me? Or is the issue that I'm not really responding to the evidence that I've been given? Because, of course, the point is that we can't expect to receive any more revelation from God if we are shutting our eyes to the revelation that he has already given us, whether that's in creation or supremely in Jesus. But it's interesting, the people here in this passage aren't quite in that category. So these are people who are not denying the miracles. They can't deny them. They wouldn't want to deny them. They love Jesus' miracles. We see that in verse 45. They welcome Jesus. So these aren't kind of obstinate people refusing to believe. But still, there's something false about their faith. And I've put there, what makes their faith a false faith is that it loves the gift more than the giver. That's striking. Throughout John's gospel, he consistently uses a particular word for miracles. And we've seen it a whole load of times already. It's that word, signs. Look at verse 54. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Other gospel writers, they prefer to refer to them as miracles or as mighty deeds. But John always calls them signs or sometimes works. And so for John, the whole emphasis on Jesus' miracles is that the miracles function as signposts. They're signs. They exist entirely to point away from themselves, like a signpost does, and to point to Jesus and to his identity. But what we see as we look through John's gospel again and again is that people often show this weird kind of false faith where they get so transfixed by the sign that they never look beyond and see what the sign is pointing them to. They love the miracles, but they don't take the next step and love the miracle worker. And you can see what's perverse and ridiculous about that. It's like, you're on a journey, you're off to see something amazing. Last week we went to see the Crown Jewels, for example, where are the Crown Jewels? Tower of London. And we were on our way there. But imagine we were on our way, and just as we got kind of 100 yards away, and you see that sign which says Crown Jewels this way, there was a whole crowd of people just mesmerized by that beautiful calligraphy on the sign, completely missing that the whole point of the sign is to point beyond itself, to get everyone to go there. Or it's a little bit like, here's another illustration, a young child, and I've seen this enough times myself, whose granny or family member brings a wonderful present, and the child is so captivated by this new toy that they never look up and actually acknowledge the person who gave it to them. It's just all about the gift, rather than looking beyond the gift to the person who gave it to them. And the point John's making here is that false faith loves the gift above the giver. Now, having learned that, I think that then poses a question for us. You might be thinking that is actually a difficult call to make in our own lives. God gives wonderful gifts. He gives us health and strength. In the gospel, he gives us forgiveness of sins and certainty of eternal life. How could I know whether I love the gifts more than I love God, the giver? It's a difficult one to unravel because we don't really know our own hearts very often. But interestingly, that is one of the purposes of hard times for the Christian. It's actually only when some of our cherished gifts are taken away from us or withheld and when we're asking for them, that it starts to become clear in our own lives whether I'm in this relationship just for the gifts or whether I'm in it just to have God and to know him. So the question is, it's possible to have a kind of cupboard love for God where we're believers, but we're effectively saying to God, I'm only interested as long as you're giving me what I want. I want, you know, as long as you're giving me the job that I want, or the partner that I want, or the children that I want, or you know, the list goes on. As soon as God is not delivering on my demands, then I'm not interested anymore. And sadly, you see this sometimes when hard times come. People sometimes reveal this kind of false faith. They get resentful, they get angry with God, and occasionally they even throw in the towel. But you see, that kind of faith, which is just fixated on the gifts rather than the giver, is the spiritual equivalent of being a gold digger. You know those horrible stories you read about of people who are only in a relationship for what they can extract out of it. It's very ugly. And that kind of gold digger faith is, of course, a great dishonor to God. And hard times are what distinguish for us which kind of faith ours is. So in chapter 2, and we see it here again in chapter 4, Jesus is not impressed simply by attention, by people crowding around him, people following him. And he's not impressed because actually there's all kinds of reasons why someone might show an interest in Jesus. But Jesus is clear, he does not want just gold diggers. He wants true believers. Believers who love him and not just the gifts, not just the miracles. But then into this context of false faith, which is what characterizes this whole region and which Jesus has been exposing, into this context steps this official. And he displays for us a completely different kind of faith. He displays, I put there, a true faith, which takes Jesus at his word without demanding more proof. So let's pick up from verse 49. The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. Now, it's interesting to me that Jesus doesn't give the man what he asked for. Did you notice that? Twice we are told that the official specifically requests for Jesus to come down to Capernaum. Look at verse 47. The man went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son. Look at verse 49. The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." That's what he's asking for. But now this man is being sent away on his own. He's being sent away empty-handed. And he's got to make a 15-mile trip back to Capernaum to his dying son without the helper, the healer, that he had come to fetch. And all Jesus offers him are some words. Look at verse 50. "Your son will live." That's all Jesus is prepared to give him. Just some bare words. Just a promise. And do you see the contrast that's going on here? John is contrasting for us seeing signs with the official's experience here of merely hearing words. So do you remember the other Galileans had, verse 45, seen all that he had done? And Jesus said about them in verse 48, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you people will not believe." But this official has got nothing to see. He's got nothing to look at all, just bare words. And actually, for the man in our passage, the fact that he couldn't see what Jesus had declared, he couldn't see that his son was healed because he's 15 miles away, he just heard a promise, that was just what he needed. It was very helpful for him because it focused the issue for him beyond the miracle, beyond the signpost, and onto Jesus and his identity. The man had to make a call there and then about Jesus. "I've heard all about his signs, people have told me. Everyone's told me about his claims. Will I now take Jesus at his word and trust him? Will I walk away from here with nothing? Well, with just bare words and yet say, because this promise is from Jesus, that is enough. Do you see how Jesus focuses the issue for him on who Jesus is? And of course, it's very similar for us. The gospel, the Christian message, is by nature a promise. I wonder if you've thought about that. We looked a couple of weeks ago at John 3:16, where the promise is that whoever believes in Jesus should not perish, but have eternal life. And by giving us a promise, Jesus focuses the issue for us. And this is the first mark of true faith for us. Will we take Jesus at his word without continually each day asking for more and more and more proofs? Will we trust him? And in the first instance, this means, will we take Jesus at his word when he promises us eternal life? That's what it is to come into relationship with Jesus, to believe that gospel promise. But of course, trusting Jesus inevitably means a lot more than that. It means taking him at his word on a whole raft of other issues as well. And that will involve different challenges for each one of us every day. Every culture you'll know finds Jesus' teaching offensive on particular areas and less so in other areas. And that will vary massively from culture to culture, from age to age. So, of course, our grandparents' issues with Jesus are not our issues, and our issues are not what our grandchildren's issues are going to be. But whatever age we're in, whatever culture we're in, there will be these clashes. Today, significantly on Jesus' teaching about sexuality or him being the only way to God or whatever it is. And these clashes highlight for us whether our faith is true faith or whether, when there's a clash, whether we're really trusting our own or our culture's ideas above what Jesus teaches. The distinctive of true faith is it will take Jesus at his word. And the second thing this official demonstrates about true faith is he then obeys. So in verse 50, did you notice the man was given a command? Verse 50, go. And he was given a promise, your son will live. And those things are tied very closely. The way to show that he believed the promise was by obeying the command. Look at the rest of verse 50. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him. How do we know? Because he went on his way. And that is always the way true faith works in the Bible. Always demonstrated in action. The classic example of faith in the Bible you'll know in the Old Testament is Abraham. You may remember when God first spoke to Abram, this was back in Genesis 12, God said to him, go, very similar to here, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. So just like here, he gets given a command. And then God says, and I will make of you a great nation. So there's the accompanying promise of what will happen to Abraham, or Abram as he's called then, as he goes. And the way Abram showed that he believed that promise, well, how did we know that he believed it? Well, he packed his bags and he set off across the desert. His faith was evident in his action. And this official's experience is very similar to Abraham's experience and very similar to our experience. Just like this official, all Abraham had to go on was bare words. There was no miraculous sign for Abraham. But the point is, they were the bare words of someone infinitely authoritative and trustworthy, and someone who can therefore be thoroughly relied upon. And just like this official, the way God had given Abraham and us to show that he believes the promise is by obeying his commands. Just the same for us. So faith is what we're called to. We have to take Jesus at his word. But the point is that true faith must be expressed in obedience. Always go together. So, to clarify, the two questions I want to ask myself if I want to know if my faith is a real faith. First, am I taking Jesus at his word? Especially in those instances when Jesus' word clashes with my culture's assumptions or what I want to do. And especially when I'm going through hard times, am I going to trust Jesus? And then secondly, am I therefore obeying in whatever areas of life Jesus is currently putting his finger on for me? So the question isn't, you know, if I'm trying to work out if I've got real faith, how do I feel about Jesus today? Or have I had some impressive experiences of Jesus in the past? Or have I been used by God in other people's lives? The question is, am I obeying him? Now, that's not to say that true believers won't fail in their obedience. They will. We all fail every day. But the sign that we're true believers is that we get up again each time we fail and we keep resolving in God's strength to try and live obediently. That is the mark of true faith. Now, this path that I've been setting out of stepping out in faith and in obedience, even when we don't see the proof there right in front of us, I guess some of us are thinking, that sounds like a very uncertain, it sounds like a shaky way to live. And perhaps if you're looking in at the faith from the outside, you're thinking, will I never have spiritual assurance? Will I always have this kind of degree of uncertainty about what life's about? Well, if that's your question, what we're going to see is that as this official makes this first step of faith and obedience, and this is the point there on the sheet, he then discovers that Jesus' words have life-giving power. And that is what confirms his faith and gives him certainty. Let's keep going. Verse 51, as the man was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him. That's 1 p.m. The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And he himself believed, and all his household. So John spends these verses reinforcing for us that even though this man just has these bare words, when they are the words of Jesus, nothing could be more secure. Jesus' words are like nothing else in this world. Jesus' words have life-giving power in them. John has told us twice that his son was at the point of death. Did you see that? Verse 47, the man went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Again in verse 49, the official said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. And yet it's as a result of Jesus' words that the boy lives. In verse 50 and 53, they're life-giving words. So yes, they are mere words. But when Jesus speaks mere words, something amazing happens. Jesus' words carry divine authority. And so 15 miles away, the very cells in that child's body are healed instantly and they're renewed. I mean, how could they do otherwise when their creator has just spoken? There's no spatial limitation to Jesus' authority, whether it's 15 miles or 15 million miles. Makes no difference to Jesus' words. In our family, when we read about Jesus calming the storm, as Andrew was talking about at the beginning, those amazing words, quiet, be still. Or when we're reading in Bible time about Jesus raising the dead, that amazing moment when Jesus says, Lazarus, come out, and the corpse comes out of the tomb. In our family, we call those strong words. They are unstoppable words. And it's these strong words of Jesus that you and I get to lean on. These are the words that you and I get to build our whole lives upon. There is nothing stronger. Now, fascinatingly, we've already been told that this man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him right back in verse 50. Did you notice that? And yet what we see is a little process happens. As he responds positively to whatever revelation he had received about Jesus, maybe he had heard some story about him, now we find that he is rewarded with greater revelation and greater demonstration of Jesus' life-giving power. And his faith is then dramatically confirmed and strengthened, so that by the time we get to verse 53, it says, "And he himself believed, and all his household." Do you see that? Yes, he believed before, verse 50. But 53, now he believes even more. And that is the dynamic of faith. This is what every day is like in the Christian life. It's as we step out, as we put our trust in God, he gives us greater and greater assurance and knowledge and revelation of him. We had a clue about this back in chapter 1. Do you remember Nathanael? Chapter 1:49. Nathanael answered Jesus, "Rabbi, you're the Son of God. You're the King of Israel." Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? Ha! You will see greater things than these." That's how the dynamic works. This is the path that God has given us to greater and greater assurance. As we take Jesus at his word, oftentimes when we don't see the proof, we don't know what's going to happen. And I guess that sounds like a very shaky way to start. We might prefer that every question we had was answered, every base was covered. But it's as we step out and we see God's faithfulness that he then gives us even greater assurance and knowledge of himself. I was thinking about this. This is why being part of a small church plant is such a wonderful place for us to be. I guess we're all aware, you know, things at the beginning seem frail and uncertain. But the Lord Jesus has said, "I will build my church." So what do? Well, we take a risk. We step out, we trust him. And of course, as we do that, we see him work in remarkable ways. And that builds our faith again and again. So I don't know what this is going to look like in your situation. But I encourage each one of us today to think, what is Jesus asking me to trust him in today? Perhaps he's calling me to put to death a certain pattern of life. And we're fearful about that. Can we trust him with it? Perhaps he's calling us to be bolder about and more public about our faith. Perhaps he's calling us to be more generous with our time or with our money or whatever it is. And frankly, it makes us very nervous. So often it feels like we've got too much to lose. Of course, that is exactly how the Lord loves to grow us in our faith and to reveal himself to us in new and wonderful ways. It's as we take that first step, or that, for some of us, the 1,001st step of faith and obedience, it's as we do that that we will discover more and more there is no safer, no better place to be than for us to lean fully on the one who made us and the one who loves us. And on the one whose words are strong words and have life-changing power. I'm going to leave a time of quiet now for us to come before the Lord and to think what this is going to look like for each one of us. And then in a moment, we'll have prayers together.